Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few theaters, I would argue, of the war for the free world that are arguably more important to the security of the United States and yet, well, more taken for granted than our naval power and the capacity that we have long enjoyed to project power over the world's oceans and to ensure trade through those waters. A man who has long understood the importance of American sea power and who has worked tirelessly both in the United States government for decades and in subsequent years as a very influential figure in the world of Washington think tanks is our guest for this full hour of very special conversation. He is Seth Cropsey. Today he is the director of the Center for American Sea Power with the Hudson Institute, but he has served in the past as an assistant to the Secretary of Defense and as the Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy, among other roles, involving the understanding and the application of sea power. He is the author of several important books on the subject, Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy, and also Sea Blindness, more recently, How Political Neglect is Choking America's Sea Power and What to Do About It. Seth Cropsey, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you so much for taking a full hour to discuss these important issues with us. It's high time we do a stocktaking in all of these areas.
Frank, it's a pleasure.
I'd like to start, Seth, if I could, with just sort of the introduction to Sea Power 101. Why is it of such importance to a nation we call ourselves sometimes an island nation, flanked by two or three very important bodies of water, that we be able to exercise not only naval power, but naval superiority?
The answer is really quite simple, and you pretty much said it. This is a maritime state. We're bordered by the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, and the Caribbean. Our international commerce is born 90%, close to 100% is born by sea. And if we're not able to control the seas, or the seas are controlled by states that are hostile to us, it has a direct and profound impact on our economy. And the same thing applies to our security. The places where conflict has come from, beginning with our war for independence, Revolutionary War, and extending up to today, has been across the seas, in Europe, in Asia. So our ability to deter, or if necessary, to fight in these theaters and protect the country at a distance depends upon the power to project force. And that comes from sea power, from the Navy and Marines.
That idea of fighting elsewhere is seemingly so self-evident. I remember, though, many years ago now, Seth Cropsey, that I was asked to participate in a debate with the Libertarian Society of Washington, D.C., and they do these things very formally, as you probably know, and they propounded a resolution that we should debate, and the resolution went something like this, that there should be a constitutional amendment barring the use of American military power except for the purposes of protecting the borders of the United States. And I thought at the time this was so absurd. Wouldn't you rather make sure that you're dealing with hostile threats elsewhere rather than inside the United States or at best at its borders? And this is, of course, fundamental to the idea of sea power. And yet you've written in your newest book, Sea Blindness, about the fact that we are witnessing the sustained effects of political neglect. I'd like to, before we get into some of the manifestations of that, though, talk a little bit with you, Seth Cropsey, about the kinds of dangers that we are evidently sea blind to at the moment. Talk, for example, about arguably the most important of those emanating now from communist China.
Well, Frank, the Chinese have been turning their coastal navy into a blue water fleet for the past 25 or 30 years, with their military budget increasing by double-digit figures consistently each year for that time. So they're building, China is building a large, modern naval fleet with submarines, surface ships, aircraft carriers now, naval aviation based on the mainland. And their ships have sailed all the world's oceans. They've made ports of call in the Mediterranean, in the United States itself, in the Caribbean, in Europe. So they're developing their ability to project power at a distance. At the same time, they have a very clear focus on establishing the international waters of the South and East China Seas as territorial waters of China. And that engages American interests directly, because we have, as Thomas Jefferson understood when he changed his mind about projecting force and building a navy, we have an interest, an economic interest, and a security interest in being able to use the ocean, the international waters of the world, for security and for trade. So China is out there on all fronts, and during the time from the end of the Cold War, when we had about 600 ships in the fleet, to today, it's diminished. The size of the fleet has diminished to about 276 ships.
I want to come back to it, needless to say, but just staying with the South China Sea for a moment, one of the things that I've been struck by, Seth Cropsey, is the extent to which, in addition to what you've described in terms of the buildup of their fleet and their concomitant ability to project power, is that China is now occupying physical territory in those waters with a degree of an ability to deny us certainly the latitude we've previously enjoyed to operate there ourselves. Talk a little bit about these islands that they've manufactured and the fortification of them and what that does to the correlation of forces.
Well, I think the Chinese, as usual, are playing a long ball game over a period of time. And what they've done is the South China Sea is not a deep water area for the most part. And so there are shoals and reefs around them. They've just built them up into islands and put airstrips on some of the islands and armed them. If in a conflict today, with the balance of forces as it is right now, those islands would go away very quickly if there was a conflict between the United States and China. And not because China willed them. It was because we had a superior force. But when I talked about long ball game, they're thinking about, the Chinese are thinking and acting about establishing claims, about establishing territorial bases, putting military in there, creating a precedent, and pushing that diplomatically and by legal means and by illegal means, that over a period of time, I don't expect this to happen tomorrow. We'll make it, we'll turn that, those international waters into territorial waters.
Yeah, and possibly keep out zones. We have to pause for just a second. Seth Cropsey will be right back with more, with the author of Sea Blindness, How Political Neglect is Choking American Sea Power and What to Do About It, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting with Seth Cropsey of the Hudson Institute, a former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy and big thinker about the imperatives of American sea power, the threats thereto, and what we best do about them. Seth, we were talking a little bit about the South China Sea, the islands that have been built there. And I take your point that today, should we need to do so, we could attack those islands and neutralize the airfields and the surface-to-air missiles and the, you know, naval shipyards and the like, or port facilities at least, that are being put into place there. But as you were saying, if you take the longer-term view of this and you see it as part of a overall capacity to deny access to the area, that is what the Chinese evidently have in mind, with implications for Taiwan and Japan and South Korea and Vietnam and the Philippines and Guam and other of the nations with whom we are either friends or allies in the region. It does have, it seems to me, a profound implication, at least over time. Do you see it that way? And if so, what should we be doing about those islands now?
I do see it that way, and the South China Sea is not the only place where China is present and increasing its presence. What I mean by that, for example, is that they want to build a naval base in Djibouti, important choke point into the toward the Suez Canal. They've already built a naval base in Pakistan. They own a large portion, most of the container shipping facilities in Piraeus, Port of Athens. So they have extensive contacts in South America.
The Panama Canal, the Caribbean, we've got Azores even they're talking about, it sounds like. And Seth, we were just teasing out some of the things that just the Chinese alone, we haven't talked about the Russians or the Iranians or others who are increasingly seeking to go to sea. But just seeing this for the moment, when you look as a naval strategist at what the Chinese are putting into place in the Atlantic, in the Caribbean, in the South Asian waters, in the Western Pacific, and elsewhere, are we missing something really momentous that is perhaps slowly, incrementally, though I think an accelerating pace developing in terms of situations, I don't know if you could call them on the ground exactly, but certainly on atolls and islands and elsewhere that are having effects on waters that we care about?
Exactly. We're missing the whole thing. The United States policy has been for the past 35 or 40 years to encourage, persuade China to become a stakeholder in the liberal international order. And their actions around the world show that that attempt has failed. And there has been no policy to put in its place, and we're sort of proceeding with no hand on the rudder at all. A more sensible understanding would be that a state of strategic competition exists between the United States and China, and that that has broad implications for our diplomacy, not only with China, but with the nations that surround it and the hard power that's needed to back that up.
You know, Seth Cropsey, the state of strategic competition is one way of putting it, I guess. I friends of ours, including guests on this program, are increasingly referring to it in terms that are a little more stark. Economic war is one. War more generally, albeit perhaps of asymmetric kind rather than the traditional sort so far. Do you think that's overstating it?
No, I don't think so. I just think that the naval and military elements are included in the broader term strategic competition, and economic warfare is a part of that. So I don't disagree.
Let me just ask you then, Seth Cropsey, with these sorts of developments, just from the Chinese alone, when you factor in the evidence that the Russians are actively rebuilding their naval power projection capabilities in all of the areas that you described the Chinese are as well. Modern ships, including capable submarines and aircraft at on land and at sea, and a variety of new missiles and the like. The Iranians are projecting power, albeit modestly at the moment, but nonetheless twitting us a bit by sending ships into Cuba and South Atlantic waters. You've got the North Koreans putting an emphasis on submarine-launched ballistic missiles, for example, among other assets at sea. Does this, taken together, constitute... well, as you call it in your book, mayday for our fleet, given that we may have to contend with more than one of these adversaries at a time?
Yeah, that's the whole point, Frank. The adversaries and potential adversaries are building up their fleet, and ours has been reducing and shows no signs of significant increase, despite the administration's goodwill in trying to do something about it. But not much is happening.
Well, I want to drill down on that in the remaining time we have with you, Seth. Before we get to the numbers of ships and the size of the fleet we should be striving for, which is, of course, extraordinarily important, but let's talk about the condition of the ones we've got. We've had a series of accidents, as we've discussed in the past. We had another one just the other day, the tugboat, as I understand it, in a training exercise, scraped up against one of our guided missile ships. Are our fleet assets, and for that matter, the personnel who operate them, ready for the sorts of challenges that we're talking about?
No, I think they're ready today, but I think there are we're looking at the possibility once again of a hollow force.
But you would say that's a possibility, not a present condition. You hear these readiness ratings for naval aircraft and marine aircraft, and the problems with training of personnel on these ships. It sounds as though it's much more grim than that, Seth.
Yeah, there's a difference, as you know, Frank, between providing the logistical support and repair and maintenance and inventory of missiles that's needed in order to keep a fleet operational and combat ready, and building a larger fleet. And the money that the administration is asking for cannot do both. And so the most likely eventuality is that the limited resources that the administration is asking for and the Congress is willing to give will be applied to addressing the readiness problems that exist today.
Band-aids rather than fixing the other larger problems. We have to pause for just a second. Seth Cropsey will be right back with a further discussion of the steps that are desperately needed to get us out of this mayday situation for the United States Navy and the country right after this.
Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Seth Cropsey, the former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy and Assistant to the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, a man I had the privilege of serving as well. Seth is these days in charge of this activity or portfolio, shall we say, at the Hudson Institute's Center for American Sea Power. We're talking about the state of American sea power and what needs to be done to remedy it. He is the author of two terrific books on the subject and countless articles, May Day and Sea Blindness. And Seth, you were describing before the break the likelihood that within finite resources, we're going to wind up trying to get ourselves out of the hole we're in with respect to the readiness of the fleet at the expense of rebuilding it, which I want to talk to you about in some detail if we could. But what are the numbers that we're talking about, do you think, at this point, roughly, to restore the United States Navy to the levelness of readiness that the nation requires it to have?
Well, we're spending about something around $14 billion a year on shipbuilding. That's not going to produce a 350-ship fleet anytime soon or anytime ever. So my guess is that doubling that is the minimum that's required to build to the 350-ship level that the Trump administration and the Navy generally agree is the object. But you have to remember that that doesn't include personnel costs, doesn't include the operation and maintenance of a larger fleet. So we're talking about more money here, and there's no point in beating around the bush. Even if the larger sum were allotted, the plan is still to build to the 350 ship level in 30 years, and we don't have 30 years as far as the threats that we've already discussed this morning are concerned. We don't.
And to the extent that we're talking about the resources being made available for it, and that's a whole nother kettle of fish, do you believe that we have the capacity to absorb the kind of investment that you're talking about at the moment? Do we have the shipyards that are ready for building the new ships, or for that matter, even maintaining the existing ones, in a timely way? I guess this is part of my concern, and I think you've just touched on it. We don't have 30 years, for sure, to get well.
No, if we build gold-plated everything, we don't have that. But if we just start turning out ships that that have exceptional lethal capabilities without all of them having everything that has been deemed necessary in the past and is responsible for the high cost of ships, in part, then we have a problem. But there is certainly the defense industrial base to turn out a larger, more capable fleet in 15 as opposed to 30 years, and it can be built where it's found lacking. But I think, generally speaking, that shipbuilding in the United States has the capability today to do that.
I'm very heartened to hear you say that, because I'm reminded of how much the shipbuilding industrial base has contracted in the past 20 years or so. And by contrast, the size of the naval shipbuilding capacity of the Chinese, for example, it's staggering. I think Mark Halperin has told me on this program that there may be as many as 100 shipyards in communist China now, not all of which are devoted full-time to producing naval combatants, but could be if directed to do so, and certainly are building large seagoing vessels for commercial purposes and the like. So there's a lot of skill there. It reminds me of, you know, the kind of environment we were in at the height of World War II, where we were cranking out, you know, was it Liberty ships every day, it seemed. That's certainly not in the in the cards at the moment, is it?
No, I don't think so. But we have problems. But if the country sets its mind doing something like that, I don't foresee a problem.
If we've got those yards more or less ready to go, you know, just I'm scanning an important book that one of our future guests and previous ones, Dakota Wood, has produced at the Heritage Foundation with some of his colleagues there. He's grading the United States Navy, Seth Cropsey, on what they call a capability score as weak, and as a readiness score, marginal. And these are very ominous depictors, especially because, as you know so well, our adversaries are trying to evaluate our capabilities as well, and perhaps their willingness to act aggressively will be determined by those assessments.
It depends upon how, in the formal sense of the term, I think our capabilities are quite good. It's the capacity that I'm concerned about. So we have good ships, and they're the ones that are coming out today, and the ones that have been built in recent years are they're quite capable. But there aren't enough of them. That's the problem. And there aren't going to be enough of them in the future unless resources are applied, and that not only to ships but to more sailors and the complete infrastructure and inventory support that's necessary to keep them at sea and combat ready.
The measures of merit that they were using, just as an example, in the capability score are the age of equipment, the capability of equipment, the size of the modernization program, and the health of the modernization programs. And I guess it may just be an honest disagreement about some of those points, but I just wonder whether we're doing a little bit of whistling past the graveyard, not so much you, but I think we as a nation, Seth Cropsey, when it comes to anticipating what's needed. And while these ships, you know, the Arleigh Burke class Aegis ships, for example, have been, you know, the staple of our Navy for decades now, but they are aging, let's be clear.
Yeah, but the Navy is also building a model that has updated, modernized equipment to replace the aging ones. And I think there's a general understanding that has to be done. But my question is, again, are we building enough of them? And that's a serious problem. Yes, the fleet is aging, and the ships that were built in the Reagan administration are nearing the end of their service lives, and they have to be replaced. That's understood. But the question is, what do we have when those ships are replaced? Do we simply replace them one by one and leave it at that? Or do we have the resources to build the Navy up so that it can meet the commitments that that are increasing around the world? And that's the problem.
Yeah. And Seth, we'll have to pause here just a moment, but very quickly, is it in your professional judgment the right number to be striving for is 350 ships? I mean, would that really be sufficient?
It's the absolute minimum. It's the absolute minimum.
So the 600 ship of yesteryear is what we actually should be shooting for? Is that what's needed? Or are they, because they're more capable ships, you don't need as many? Or how would you judge that?
No, when I run the numbers, I come out with something closer to 400. Let's just put it this way. Increasing the size of the fleet from its current level of 276 to 350 or 355 would solve a lot of problems.
And will be a daunting enough task as it is. Seth, we have to pause. We'll be right back with more with former Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy, Seth Cropsey, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Seth Cropsey is in the house virtually. We're talking about naval power and what the American nation requires in order to safeguard its interests, not just around the world, but really here at home as well, not least to ensure our economic well-being by maintaining freedom of the seas. Seth has a great experience in this part of the battle space, both in the Reagan and Bush administrations. He also served, by the way, as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict. These days, he runs the Hudson Institute's Center for American Sea Power. A utility infielder, if ever there were one. Seth Cropsey, let me ask you about the size of the fleet, as you have forecasted, is hoped for at about 350. Talk about its component parts, if you will. Do you see the continuing utility of large deck aircraft carriers, nuclear powered at that, as a key piece of a fleet of whatever size, but particularly, you know, our ideals?
Yes, I do, Frank. But changes are needed. And specifically, we're going to shift one way or another, whether slowly or quickly, and I'd rather see it quickly, from manned missions to unmanned planes flying off carrier decks. And the advantage that gives us is not only the obvious one, which is that we don't put people in harm's way, but that we get planes that have much longer range. And that's important because of the missiles that the Chinese are developing, whose advertised ability is to be able to hit an aircraft carrier at sea at a distance of 1,000 miles. And the manned planes that we have right now don't have the range to do that without a great deal of tanking. So that's got to change. And it's where technology is going, and I think that the carriers will have to adapt to that. The other thing is that, having said that, I think there's the need for the large deck carriers and the number of sorties that planes from it can conduct. That doesn't mean that all the carriers should be large deck carriers. I think there should be a mix of smaller carriers that can be used in situations that are less dangerous and require less naval power, less force protection, so that we don't have to send a huge carrier to do a relatively smaller business. The large carriers ought to be reserved for places like China, for the West Pacific, for possibilities like those that exist today off the Korean Peninsula. But they're not necessarily needed if the object is a group of terrorists somewhere in the Middle East. So I think the mix needs to change.
It is noteworthy that in recent days we've had three of those large deck carrier battle groups operating off of the Korean Peninsula, and demonstration of American resolve, one would hope, that would be unmistakable from Kim Jong-un's vantage point. Let me ask you about submarines, Seth Cropsey. This is an area where we've long prided ourselves on having the best of the undersea fleets of the world, but their numbers have been shrinking. And I wonder what priority you would assign to getting those numbers back up, especially in light of improvements that have been made in diesel and other unconventionally powered vessels and their proliferation around the world.
You know, the submarine is the ultimate stealth weapon, at least for today and for the foreseeable future. And it's simply a question of time until the Chinese are able to outnumber us effectively. and numbers of ships that's already close to parity.
And how about the quality?
Well, the quality doesn't match. The quality doesn't match. And that comes back to the question we were talking about before about capability and capacity. Our capabilities are unmatched. The capacity is a problem, though, because if you can flood the oceans with lots of diesel electric submarines, you increase the problem tremendously.
I think it was Stalin who said that quantity has a quality all its own. And to the extent that we are watching, again, not just the Chinese building up their undersea capabilities, but also the Russians and to varying degrees others, is there a concern, Seth Cropsey? I know the Navy has been very insistent for decades on keeping their ships nuclear-powered, these submarines. Is there an argument for looking at a mix of power systems to ensure that we get more numbers of our own?
Yeah, that's a very good argument for that. The diesel-electric submarines or air-independent propulsion submarines are considerably less expensive than nuclear ones. More boats in the water, under the water, significantly complicates the potential enemies and enemies' problem. But while we're talking about this, it's also important to note the unmanned underwater craft. Underwater submarines can also be a large force multiplier, and that's something that significant resources need to be spent on.
Yeah, there's some real concern about a very powerful one that the Russians seemingly are building that has quite considerable range and the possibility of delivering a very large thermonuclear weapon. It's a case in point, I think. Let me ask you about one other area, Seth Cropsey, quickly. I've been a proponent for a long time, as I think have you, of having missile defenses at sea where they can be moved easily and without getting a lot of permission and provide increasing areas of protection against the sorts of missiles you mentioned, threatening our carriers today, but also our nation. How important is that mission to the United States Navy, and should it be, especially as you're looking at building out the fleet?
Yeah, very important. As missiles are perfected and the means of delivering them, both launched from land and from naval aircraft, increase, and I'm again talking about the West Pacific, not only our fleet, but places like Guam and the bases that we have in South Korea and Japan are increasingly vulnerable to missile attack. So if we were going to get serious about the problem here, we'd be looking at ballistic missile defense throughout the missile's flight, the enemy missile's flight, and we don't have that capability yet. And a significant investment needs to be made in that.
Seth Cropsey, there's so much more to talk about on all of this. We don't have time to even get into, let alone do justice to the question of what the effects have been on the Navy and its performance of some of what's been described as social engineering. I'm mindful of the impact of women getting pregnant on ships, causing disruption in their readiness and perhaps even their deployments and so much more. But that's for another day. In the meantime, I do want to thank you, Seth, for the long service you've given to the country in the area of American sea power, trying to ensure we have it and that we use it effectively. Your books on the subject, including most recently Sea Blindness, How Political Neglect is Choking American Sea Power and What to Do About It, are really required reading for all of us concerned about the national security. And I thank you for those, as well as your service in government and many, many years in the past. Keep up the good work, my friend, at the Hudson Institute. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.